Listen up, people. We've got one last chance to double your impact when you donate during this May fundraiser. It's Match Monday, and the Investors Challenge Fund is matching donations today only up to $25,000. We need to put every single dollar of these funds to use for our newsroom in the months ahead so we can keep you and people across this country informed. Please give right now and generously at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks. Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The fine print, gang. You got to read the fine print. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 18th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We try and mostly succeed, I think, in staying out of the weeds on this program. There lies peril if you are trying to make this economy understandable. But sometimes the weeds are where the story is, so I am obliged to quote to you now footnote number 2 from table 1 of this morning's report on June retail sales. I told you we were going to get down in the weeds. Here's the quote of that footnote. Estimates are concurrently adjusted for seasonal variation, the footnote reads, and for holiday and trading day differences, but not for price changes. Not, in other words, adjusted for inflation. So, while what you might have seen and heard since the news came out this morning, the retail sales in June were up 0.2% from May, what you should be thinking is, are we actually buying more stuff, or are we buying less and just paying more for it? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Spending has grown the past couple of years, which on the face of it is good for the economy.
Part of that was reflecting higher prices, not necessarily the fact that consumers are buying more products.
Lydia Basur is senior economist at EY Parthenon.
Retail sales, or what consumers have really been buying, the volume of sales, have been quite flat and is actually down on a year-over-year basis.
Inflation and spending are kind of in this nasty race. You spend more, good for the economy, but you're actually getting the same amount of stuff or less, which is at some point not so good.
And so right now the race is pretty neck and neck.
Sophia Begg is an economist at Business Intelligence for Morning Consult. There is a caveat to all of this. What we have today are retail sales numbers. Retail sales is just retail sales. It doesn't include things like airfare or services. If you add that in, which Morning Consult did, you find the economy has been on quite a journey this year.
What we've seen in our data is consumer spending was very strong in the beginning of the year in January and February. In March and April, it took a decline.
A lot of that was higher income consumers, Begg says, who were affected more by tech layoffs and fear during that whole banking sector crisis. Now, she says, those folks are spending more on vacations, baseball games, entertainment.
And so I'm not as surprised to see retail sales tucker out a little bit because it seems like there's a little bit of a substitution effect where people are prioritizing spending on experiences this summer more than they are spending on goods.
So what this all means is that, yes, we are still dealing with inflation, but as that inflation comes down, the consumer is, for now, holding on. Paul Ashworth is chief U.S. economist at Capital Economics.
I mean, in broad terms, it is consistent with the early data that the economy will avoid recession, so achieve a soft landing.
Meaning we may not be spending like crazy, but things are generally okay. So as inflation goes down, the economy isn't necessarily going down with it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say traders are all in on the soft landing. We will have the details when we do the numbers. I gave this a quick nod on the way out yesterday, but it's worth a revisit. It is getting harder to get a loan in this economy. According to the New York Fed's most recent survey of consumer expectations, lenders rejected nearly 22% of all loan applications over the past 12 months. That is up 4.5 percentage points since the last survey. That was in February, and it is the highest the rejection rate has been in more than 5 years. But while it is getting harder to get a car loan or a credit card or to refinance a mortgage, that is kind of exactly what the Fed wants to have happen. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes is on that one.
When 29-year-old Edward Van Ostrom went to buy a used car last month, they knew they couldn't cover the whole $25,000 price tag. So they applied for a loan at the Baltimore dealership, which got rejected. So did their second application. And then the third.
I felt like I was going to throw up the whole time. Like, why can't we just get what we need?
Van Ostrom doesn't have the best credit score. They were out of work for a couple years and defaulted on their credit cards. Eventually, they decided to make a small down payment, and the application went through. But their experience is becoming more common.
It's getting harder to get most different types of loans.
Matt Schultz is chief credit analyst at LendingTree. He points out that the delinquency rate for credit cards has been gradually ticking up, and lenders are wary of student loans coming due again this fall.
Most people's financial wiggle room is pretty small, even before they have to start repaying their student loan.
Banks are also trying to protect themselves as they cast nervous glances in their rearview mirrors. Tim Quinlan's a senior economist at Wells Fargo.
When you look at a list of the largest bank failures in American history, 3 out of the top 4 have all occurred this year.
And if rejecting loan applications also forces consumers to stop spending at such a fast clip, that could help pull down inflation, which, Quinlan says, on a macroeconomic level, is exactly what the Fed wants.
They're trying to kind of throw some sand into the gears of the economy and slow things down a little bit.
That doesn't make things any less painful for individual consumers whose spending's being slowed down when they just want to get in their new cars and go. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
It's not just consumers who need and increasingly can't get credit in this economy. We learned this morning home builders were feeling just a little bit better about things in June than they felt in May. That data is from the National Association of Home Builders, which says one big reason home builders are upbeat is that there's still a whole lot of demand for what they do, given how little supply there is for their finished product. But builders do face some challenges, not least of which, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, is getting a loan.
Homebuilders have been on a wild ride since the early days of the pandemic. Back then, they had a lot of trouble getting building materials because of the congested supply chain. They had a hard time finding workers because of the tight labor market. And getting a loan was the least of their concerns.
You had interest rates that were lower. You had rent growth that was just exploding across the market.
That's John Kirk, managing director of Embry, an apartment construction company based in San Antonio. He says as a result, banks felt safe lending to builders. But then, about a year ago, Kirk says things started to change.
You have the interest rates that are rising. They rose so quick. You have rent growth. You know, it went from 10% one quarter down to 3% the next quarter. So it trailed off really fast.
As a result, construction loans suddenly looked riskier, and lenders got more cautious. Odetta Kushi is deputy chief economist at First American. She says the bank failures that happened earlier this year made lenders even more nervous, especially after customers at some banks pulled out their deposits.
As long as the fear of deposit flight keeps banks sort of on the conservative side of risk management, we might see this tightening in lending standards for construction loans.
Kushi says there's still plenty of demand for new housing right now, especially since rising mortgage rates have kept a lot of existing homes off the market. But Kushi says the lending slowdown could start to make home builders pull back.
The way that we would see that is a slower new project pipeline. So maybe less groundbreaking on new homes than would have otherwise occurred if we were in a normal lending environment.
That's already started to happen with urban developments, says John Kirk, the apartment builder. That's because high rises with hundreds of units are expensive to build, so they require a lot of borrowing.
they're just not getting done just because of the total capitalization of how big they are.
Kirk says that means housing supply could fall further in 2 or 3 years when those buildings would have otherwise come onto the market. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
For lo, these past three and a half years, we have done story after story after story that have had more or less the same takeaway. This economy is weird. It's full of contradictions. With the pandemic came a quick recession, the biggest government relief packages in history, generationally high unemployment, yet consumers were spending on appliances and furniture, forget trying to buy a used car, and we are still spending today, even though inflation. And if this economy is confusing to you, it is bewildering to the experts, too. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes it from there.
Over the past few years, I've talked to a lot of experts about the chaos happening in the economy, and their answers have often boiled down to, well, something like this.
It's confusing. There are lots of new things going on. We don't quite know what we're doing these days.
Laura Veldkamp is an economist at Columbia University. And when I get an answer like this, at first, I feel a bit relieved. Like, oh, it's not just me. And then it feels unsettling. These are the economists. They are supposed to be the experts on inflation and supply chains and consumer spending.
We've studied each of these things on their own, but all of them are happening together. Holy smokes, like, we've never planned on having this many big changes all at once.
Veldkamp says when everything's happening at the same time, it's hard to determine cause and effect. That messes with economists' predictions and their heads. The usual rules don't necessarily apply.
You can find something that supports your theory, your argument, your policy proposal. It's a big ink blot. You see a dog. I see clouds in a sky. You know, who knows?
It means sometimes predictions are off. Lawrence Ball is an economist at Johns Hopkins University.
I was a loyal member of Team Transitory.
As in, Team Inflation is temporary. Ball was also a member of Team We Can't Bring Down Inflation Without Bringing Up Unemployment. He says so far, he's been wrong there too.
That is good for the overall economy. It's somewhat bad for the credibility of my research.
And he says that's been pretty humbling.
But I think it's just, you know, reflects the fact that economic science is just not all that advanced in understanding inflation.
Especially when you throw in the most unpredictable piece of all, human behavior. The differences in how Americans reacted to a deadly illness and how that experience affected where we live, what we do for work, and how we spend money.
We don't have a lot of information to make predictions on that.
Betsy Stevenson is an economist at the University of Michigan, and she says this really became a reality for her during the early stages of the pandemic, when her students were floating heads on her computer. She was trying to teach them about Social Security and tax policy and economic behavior, and she says those concepts didn't always align with what was happening.
Models that didn't match what they saw out the window became even tougher to teach because the students were looking for things that were going to be useful in helping them understand what was happening in the world.
She says on the bright side, if we're ever faced with a pandemic again, economists will have more information for their students and for journalists and in turn, you. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I live in Brooklyn. I can't go to my neighborhood deli and buy a bagel with Bitcoin.
No, no, you cannot. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 366, just under 1.1%, closed at 34,951. The NASDAQ added 108 points, about 0.75%, 14,353. The S&P 500 up 32, that's points, 7/10 is percent, 45 and 54 there. Banking crisis? What banking crisis? Morgan Stanley picked up 6.4% today, even though it reported profits were down from last year. The bank's CEO said on the earnings call this morning that the economy's on the way to a trading and banking rebound. So there. Regional banks had a good day, too. FB Financial rose 6.5%. PacWest Bancorp grew 8.5%. Taking a look at some of those more confident home builders Justin Ho was telling us about. Pulte Group climbed 0.4%. Toll Brothers and D.R. Horton both slipped about 0.1%. As, by the way, the yields on the 10-year Treasury note down to 3.78%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's Ascensus.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Crypto ain't what it was even a couple of years ago. Once held up as the holy grail of decentralized finance and the future of money, it has had a tough run. The collapse of major cryptocurrencies like Terra and Luna, the meltdown of FTX, and the associated arrest of its former CEO, Sam Bankman-Fried, charged, among other things, with fraud, have turned that crypto promise into crypto winter. But there is too much money and too many people investing to leave crypto unexamined. So actor and director and now author Ben McKenzie wrote a book about it and fundamentally was trying to figure out whether crypto is legit. Spoiler alert, he says no. The book with co-author Jacob Silverman is called Easy Money, Cryptocurrency, Casino Capitalism, and the Golden Age of Fraud. Ben, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Kai.
Why crypto? I mean, you've got a gig and a life and a thing. I mean, you know.
I know. Well, it was the pandemic. I was bored. truly. Showbiz, my normal profession, was put on ice. I saw all these knuckleheads getting rich on things like meme stocks and crypto and stuff. And I got FOMO. Hmm. And I have a degree in economics. So I dusted that off. And I thought, you know, what if I, like, invested, right? I mean, if these guys are making money, surely I can do it. A buddy of mine suggested I buy Bitcoin. I didn't know what it was. I thought about investing in it. And then I thought, wait a minute, these things aren't currencies. They're not doing what currencies do. So what are they? And that started the journey.
This is going to beg the question a little tiny bit, but how long did it take you before you started looking into cryptocurrencies until you decided it was all a sham?
I mean, it took time. You don't want to jump to that conclusion. I mean, that's a pretty big conclusion, right? Like the whole thing is at best a speculative bubble and at worst predicated on fraud, which is ultimately where I got to. But initially, I just needed to understand what the heck was going on because nothing really made sense. You know, these cryptocurrencies are not currencies, economically speaking, because they don't do what money does. I live in Brooklyn. I can't go to my neighborhood deli and buy a bagel with Bitcoin. They were being used as an investment. Then the words just kept getting weirder and weirder. There were these things called stable coins that turned out to not be so stable. Things were called decentralized, and yet they were not. They were actually centralized. The further I went in, the further I was like, maybe I'm crazy. Look, I'm a middle-aged former teen idol with a 20-year-old degree in economics. Like, well, surely this is a possibility that I've got this all wrong, because the most famous people on earth are telling me, you know, I should buy this stuff. And as a slightly less famous person, you know, it's a little daunting. But what if I'm right? You know, what if I'm right? This is terrifying, you know, that 40 to 50 million Americans are buying this stuff.
We're gonna get to Hollywood and celebrities and all of this in a second. But one of the things that came to me in this book, and look, I've been a crypto skeptic for a while, and that won't be a surprise to anybody who's listening to this program. But it's an open secret sort of in the crypto world that there are challenges, shall we say, with this entire idea.
Yes. I mean, there are true believers in cryptocurrency, and I understand the appeal, because the story of cryptocurrency is sort of fabulous, right? It's going to free them from the shackles of traditional finance and all of the, you know, myriad flaws. The further I went into it, the more bizarre it got. And I kept thinking, at some point, as I worked my way up the chain of the sort of the hierarchy of crypto, which it'll shock you, crypto, for all its talk of decentralization, is highly hierarchical, much like a multi-level marketing scheme or a pyramid scheme. And, you know, starting at the bottom, talking to kind of regular people, no offense to them, and then moving up for, you know, all the way to the top, which was Sam Bankman-Fried, I kept thinking, you know, eventually I'm going to hit somebody who can, like, explain this to me in a way that doesn't seem like total baloney. And I interviewed Sam for over an hour in July, and it was deeply unsatisfying.
Here comes a compound question, which is the worst kind of question to ask, but I'm going to do it anyway. Do you suppose that crypto eventually let's go with the granddaddy and let's say it's Bitcoin, but there is a crypto out there. Let's say there's a crypto out there that actually becomes real money that you can use as a medium of exchange and a tool of accounting and all of those things that actual money does. Which is more likely, that or then it collapses under its own weight?
The first is actually an illusion. It actually can't work, because let's go down that road for a second.
Yeah.
Let's imagine that there is a cryptocurrency that can actually serve as money. Well, one of the obvious questions is, okay, where is this? So crypto is obviously free of state control. That's what it's advertising, right? It's not issued by any country. Okay, where is this magical new form of money going to come? Corporations. We've actually tried this before. In the 19th century, during the free banking era, banks were allowed to issue their own notes. This was also called the wildcat banking era. So you would sometimes set your bank up as far away from your depositors as possible, where the wildcats roamed. Once you had their money and you were way out in the boonies, what's to stop you from running away with it? And fraud happened, you know, quite a lot. So crypto is actually just fundamentally wrong. It just doesn't understand the nature of money. If you don't mind, I can continue on this thread a little bit.
Go ahead.
Okay. So what is money?
I'm going to let you ramble on this one, and I say that in the kindest possible way because it matters, right? Oh. This is actually about what money is.
Yes. 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 This is absolutely essential if we are to learn anything from cryptocurrency. Money ultimately is trust. When I give you a piece of paper with green markings on it, why do you take it from me? Because you know you can then use that money elsewhere. Cryptocurrency famously says, oh, we can replace that. Crypto can be a trustless form of money where all you have to do is trust the code. But code does not fall from the sky. You're trusting the people that write the code. And a good example of this and the failures here is Sam Bankman-Fried's empire.
Yeah.
What's alleged in the court documents is that Sam instructed one of his lieutenants to change a single number in millions of lines of code to create a secret backdoor where he could effectively borrow, quote unquote, borrow his customers' money. The idea that crypto could someday in the future work is unfortunately just not true. It fundamentally misunderstands the nature of money, and it fundamentally is very dangerous
Because at the end of the day, in an era of rampant misinformation, we actually need to build more trust.
Last thing, and I'll let you go because I know you got things to do because the book comes out. You alluded to this. I mentioned it earlier. How come Hollywood got so wrapped up in this? I mean, we all saw that Fortune Favors the Brave ad and just went, oh my God, really, Matt Damon?
Well, the answer to that is depressingly simple. Celebrities got paid in real dollars to tell you to take your real dollars and turn them into something else.
Huh.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. And I'm not impugning the motives of the, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what anyone was thinking. So I'm not saying this or that celebrity like knew what they were doing. My suspicion is they didn't. And their agents came to them and were like, hey, you're going to make X million dollars for doing basically nothing. And the celebrity said, where do I sign? I would love for a celebrity to just be like, hey, I screwed up. I apologize. You know, that would be really nice. But my guess is their lawyers are advising them not to do that.
Are you surprised by how, because to write a book takes some obsession. Are you surprised by how obsessed you got with this topic?
Yeah. And the only person more surprised is probably my wife, who's like, Jacob and I joke, we're going to start a support club for, wives whose husbands have gotten into crypto or crypto skepticism. It's like, oh my God, would you guys please shut up about this stuff? But I do find it fascinating because it ties in economic history and economic fundamentals and, you know, all this stuff. It's interesting. Psychology.
Well, it is, I will tell you, a great book. It's called Easy Money by Ben McKenzie and Jacob Silverman, about crypto and the perils therein. Ben, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai. This was a blast.
This final note on the way out today, it's not quite flying cars, and yes, there are kind of those already, but the Federal Aviation Administration said today electric air taxis might only be a couple of years away. The FAA released a blueprint this morning for air taxi operations at scale, that's their word, at one or more sites by 2028. The catch, one among many really, is that the government is close to but has not yet certified any of the aircraft that might provide said air taxi service. All right, here is your moment of economic context. A quick real estate tidbit to follow on to Justin's story about home builders. Some data from Redfin. The brokerage firm says the home turnover rate in the first half of the year is the lowest it has been in a decade. 14 of every 1,000 homes in this economy changed hands January through June. That is compared to 19 of every 1,000 homes in this economy back in 2019. Mortgage rates, people. Mortgage rates. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of Digital and On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.